Blackstone Publishing presents St. Nicholas Salvage and Wrecking by Dana Haynes. This book is read by Victor Bavine. To Tim King and Andy Priebe, two friends who helped research stories and who listened to my endless pitches. Tim traveled with me to many of the locations in this book. Andy helped me with my flights of imagination. Deepest gratitude for the stories we've created together. To Katie, we that are true lovers run into strange capers. Prologue. Sevastopol, Crimea, 3 years ago. If you look up Bedlam on any crime-fighting website, they will link you to Sevastopol and the Ukrainian drug runner pantomime. Anything that couldn't go bad did. Anything that could go bad caught fire. American law enforcement, European intelligence agencies, Russian military, all coming together with the intent of stopping one criminal, the number one drug-running kingpin in the entire Black Sea region. Each with their own agenda, each with their own chain of command, each with their own political oversight. Bedlam. From the beginning, sparks flashed between one of the Americans, a feisty, wiry investigator from the U.S. Marshals Service, and one of the Spanish intelligence officers, a tall, angular woman who tended to stand in the back of the room during briefings, arms crossed, looking dark and sullen. His name was Michael Patrick Finnegan, and he wanted a completely proper, by-the-book, American-style arrest, leading to an indictment, leading to a trial, leading to prison time. Her name, and it took Finnegan 3 days before anyone would tell him this, was Catalin Fierro Dejar. She seemed perpetually angry. She also seemed to have bad clock, constantly checking her watch and sighing irritably. They were calling the Ukrainian drug runner Pantomime. During one of the heated, shouted, pointless Tower of Babel meetings, Finnegan demanded a proper arrest of Pantomime. Fierro said it would be faster to shoot the fat bastard. "That's not our job," the American snapped back. She swiped long, straight hair away from her eyes. "Don't be naive." Finnegan fumed. "This has to be done right. We need to put him away." "Yes, this has to be done right," the Spaniard countered. "We need to put him down." "We're law enforcement," she stormed out of the room. "You're law enforcement." A day passed. Embassies sent contradictory messages to the participating agencies. Wires got crossed. Pecking orders got pecked to death. Finnegan took the time to look into the intense, angry Spaniard. She was nominally a soldier, but without rank, insignia, or unit affiliation. She held herself apart from the other Spanish officials. He learned she was part Algerian. The others in her party treated her like sweaty dynamite, ready to explode at any time. Fierro also asked about the annoying American. He'd been a cop in New York City, she found, then joined the Marshals Service. His countrymen called him the Boy Scout and Honest John, behind his back, and shook their heads. The less Finnegan learned about Fierro, the harder he dug. He poked and prodded. A prosecutor from Cordoba finally spoke to him off the record. "Fierro, leave that one alone." "Why?" The man looked around to make sure they were alone. His voice dropped. "That one is Oscuro Sicaria." Finnegan looked it up. The Dark Assassin. It all came to a head on the night they'd planned for Pantomime's arrest. The various agents, including Finnegan, were spread throughout a sprawling maritime warehouse and train yard outside Sevastopol. Communications were spotty. Cooperation more so. Was this a military or law enforcement operation? Would Pantomime be taken inside the warehouse or outside? Which agency was in charge? The Americans wanted to go all in. The Russians threatened to pull out. Shortly after midnight, Finnegan heard the distinct crack of gunfire. His earpiece squawked. "Pantomime down! Pantomime down!" Finnegan was outside, near the train tracks. He spun, eyes looking everywhere, hand lingering near his holstered Glock. Down? The drug runner wasn't even supposed to arrive for another hour. Confusion and tumult assaulted him through his earpiece. "Who fired? Target's dead! Jesus! All units fall back to the rally point. Find the shooter. Belay that. Finnegan turned and caught the faintest glimpse of someone leaping off the roof of the warehouse, ink black against a jet black sky, no more than the suggestion of movement. The form, if it was a form and not a figment of his imagination amidst the confusion, dropped straight down onto the roof of an unmoving Russian freight train. Finnegan was maybe 200 yards back. He yelled into his mic, "Got the shooter in pursuit!" The radios went nuts. "Who responded? Who is that? Hold position, do not engage. All units, help Finnegan. All units, stop the American." Finnegan ignored it all, sprinted in the direction of the shadow. He ripped the earpiece away, felt it bounce against his shoulder blade as he hauled ass into the train yard, running parallel to the train. He heard a ka-thunk, and then again and again, all up and down the line, the repeated sound echoing off the faded warehouse fronts. The engine safeties had disengaged, the mile-long freight train gearing up to leave the grimy, rat-infested station. Finnegan didn't know any details yet. The target, Pantomime, was down. He'd been shot. That meant a crime. That was all Finnegan needed to know. Like a dumb dog chasing a ball, he didn't need to know why he was chasing it. He just needed to catch it. He picked up his speed. Finnegan ran parallel to the train. He heard the faintest tap of rubber soles on metal and felt sure that the hitter was running the length of the train, too, but up top, leaping from car to car. Fierro, the Spaniard, Algerian, whatever. She'd been the only person on the joint task force who appeared athletic enough to do that. "Stop," he bellowed as she continued to flee in a sprint. "Hey, police, stop!" She ran along the top of the train in the direction of the engine cars, which were a half mile ahead of Finnegan's location. Now the train started to move. It began with a palsy lurch, a giant dragon stirring from a century's sleep. It would travel a foot per minute, then a yard per minute. Then the train would be racing into the night toward Zhankoy and the narrow crossing of the Sea of Azov. Get that far and the train and the suspect, Fierro, would be gone forever. "Stop, goddammit!" Finnegan kept sprinting, inhaling deep, the air of the old train yard a stew of lead and asbestos and every carcinogen known to man. He heard English and Spanish and Russian and French, tinny and incoherent, bubbling from the earpiece that swung behind him on its pigtail wire. The task force hadn't even been able to agree on a common tongue, let alone a common definition of win. Finnegan wasn't a big man. At 5'8", he was light and fast. He liked to say, "I'm faster than any bastard is tougher in me, but I'm tougher than any bastard is faster in me." That had been his father's mantra when the old man was a New York City cop. The same for Finnegan's uncles and grandfather. Nobody ever picked the Finnegan boys to win a basketball game, just the fight after the game. He ran faster than the iron behemoth and caught up to the connector between two of the cars. There he saw a flash of leg way up high leaping from one car to the other. Catalan Fierro Dahar, the Oscura Sicaria. He had no doubts about that now. The train was still much slower than Finnegan, but it was picking up speed. Fierro had selected her 1,000-ton magic carpet well. Finnegan picked it up, boots pounding into the loose gravel, sprinting now, arms pumping, pulling ahead of this car. He reached the next space between cars, kept running. "I will goddamn shoot you," he bellowed. "Stop running!" He thought he caught a glimpse of her jumping in his peripheral vision. She was now a second behind him. He sprinted on. The train chugged, gaining a little momentum. Finnegan got to the end of the next car, then 10 paces beyond, and stopped, dropping to one knee, gravel digging into his skin, his right knee up, bracing his right elbow. He drew his Glock Auto, clutched his right wrist with his left hand. He aimed. He had no hope of hitting the crazy Spaniard while she jumped between cars. She was just too damn fast. So he fired before she jumped. He aimed for the vertical wall that made up the rear of the next car, aiming above the door. He was going for a bank shot. His bullets, he hoped, would hit the iron and ricochet back into her path, maybe get her to stop or to stumble, maybe. He fired twice, one shot after the other, sparks flying off the iron wall of the boxy car, both bullets caroming backward and upward into the night. He heard a muffled grunt, then nothing. He knelt, listening. The train threw up a terrible racket, despite, or perhaps because of, its glacially slow start. No chance I actually hit her, he thought. It had been an in-the-dark Hail Mary, the equivalent of casting a fishing line into a lake and bonking the fish on the top of the head with a lead weight. But Finnegan heard the distinctive crunch of boots landing on gravel on the far side of the slow-rolling train. She'd hopped down. He holstered his weapon and dodged between two of the cars. He climbed up on the ironwork, tossed his leg over the coupling device, and hopped down on the far side. The Spaniard tackled him. Finnegan saw her coming and twisted, hip-checking her away. He slammed back into the moving car and bounced off it, going to one knee. She was up and running, perpendicular to the tracks now, toward a cavernous abandoned warehouse 30 paces on. She limped, favoring one leg. Finnegan preened a little, thinking he'd hit her with a bank shot. That would be one to brag about at the bars until, well, forever. He rose to follow, already shaping the anecdotes in his head, when his vision warped. The planet's gravity shifted. He stumbled and put a hand to his midriff. Felt a knife handle. His first thought, why is there a knife handle in my shirt? Then, oh. He yanked the knife out, let it clatter to the stones. He realized something had deflected the blow, his ballistic vest, his belt perhaps. Rather than a 4-inch-deep incision, the blade had sliced him laterally, long but not deep. The bolster of the knife had caught in the cloth of his shirt, which now bloomed with a dark stain of blood. He raced after her, one hand on the stomach wound. Fierro disappeared into the warehouse. The place was abandoned, falling apart, asymmetrical. The north end had collapsed under some winter snow, maybe, or fallen victim to termites. The south end stood, black and foreboding, a hole in the dark sky, a silhouette of structure. He ran inside. 20 paces in, his left leg forgot how to lift properly, and he tripped on an old flue brick, sprawling. It was too dark to see much. His hand felt sticky with blood. He sensed more than saw, a solid substance a few feet to his left, and crab-walked toward it, left hand on the ground, supporting himself. He reached the old, creosote-soaked wooden beam and collapsed against it. He sat, drew his Glock, and tried to breathe normally. The pain pulsed in his gut. He heard the distinctive ratchet of a handgun slide in the dark, somewhere to his left. She spoke English. "You're the American, Finnegan?" He remembered now that her voice was low and husky, a smoker's voice, though she sure as hell didn't run like a smoker. He said, "Fierro, right?" She began to swear. At least he assumed from the venom sound that it was swearing. It was a Gatling gun goulash of Spanish and Arabic. She drifted to English at the end. "You shot me, son of a whore. You stabbed me." He waited, trying to triangulate her position. She said, "Yes, well, you shot me first." Seconds ticked by, and Finnegan snorted a laugh. He had no earthly idea why. It was the simple petulance of her comment. A second later, and she laughed too. "You're psychotic," he said. "Yes, try to keep that in mind." "Where did I shoot you?" She said, "Hip." "Hurt?" "Just a graze." Finnegan settled back against the pillar. "You have the right to remain silent." "You haven't met many Spanish women." They both laughed, which for Finnegan hurt like hell. Bats flitted overhead, sonar bouncing. The train outside chugged and hissed and finally passed on by. He said, "We wanted the asshole alive to face charges," she said. "We wanted the asshole dead. He'd faced charges before. So what? He was let off."
"So you just executed him?"
"Last time the Americans arrested him, they put him in a witness protection. From there he ran his rackets across the globe, and you knew it."
She wasn't wrong. The Ukrainian had flipped, providing evidence for almost a dozen major arrests. And yes, he'd continued to profit from his own evils throughout. Finnegan felt the wound right above his belt line. It hurt, but it wasn't fatal. It likely had begun clotting while he sat there. He wiped sweat off his forehead. They sat in silence. After a while, Finnegan lowered the hammer on his gun, sure that she could hear it. He holstered the weapon and then stood, grunting, one hand tacky with creosote, the other tacky with blood.
Depending on where she was, he might have been backlit by the barn door. He started back the way he'd come, toward the entrance and the tracks and the night. Halfway there, he stopped.
You can't just assassinate people. You can't pretend to stop people like that with arrest warrants. My ends may not justify my means, but neither do yours.
Your way isn't justice.
Yes, but yours isn't either.
Finnegan reached the exit and looked back over his shoulder, into the pitch black. The darkness stared back at him. Far away, sirens blared and men in boots ran on gravel. Behind his back, his earpiece chirped nonsensically like a grown-up in a peanut special.
Look, my way doesn't always work, Finnegan said. But there are rules, lady. We follow the rules, or we're just as bad as the bad guys.
The darkness said,
my way doesn't always work either. I know this. But when your precious rules don't work, then what? Do nothing? That way is just as bad as your bad guys.
So where does that leave us? He stood, clutching his gut, waiting. The darkness said,
I don't know. Do you?
Finnegan listened to the muted cacophony of his earpiece, listened to the fading sound of the freight train heading toward Russia, thought about how little he cared that Pantomime was dead. He turned toward the darkness and said,
I've got an idea.
Chapter 1. Kyrenia, Cyprus. 6 months after Michael Patrick Finnegan and Catalin Fierro Dahar met and wounded each other in Ukraine, they were in business together. Both had had their fill of bureaucracy. Both wanted to see their work mean something. But Finnegan had set one inviolate restriction. We'll break rules, we'll break laws, but we aren't assassins. Fierro agreed, reluctantly. Finnegan was a cop through and through. He was a slow, methodical, and imaginative investigator. Fierro was a spy. She could get into places and be whomever she needed to be to get to the truth. Fierro had a contact in the International Criminal Court, an anonymous go-between who threw a few thousand dollars their way under the table to connect actionable evidence to a wily Portuguese smuggler. The smuggler had evaded capture for a decade. It took Finnegan and Fierro 3 days. The evidence was rock solid, the conviction a slam dunk. Fierro hadn't understood the colloquialism slam dunk. Finnegan explained it to her. Their source at the court, an Englishman it turned out, sent more cases their way, harder cases, with more money on the line. What they were doing wasn't legal in the strictest sense. Okay, it wasn't legal in any sense. Shan Grayson, they eventually learned his name, their back-channel liaison to the court, knew a banker who could help hide the profits. And Fierro knew mercenaries for the times when violence ensued. They made 100,000 euros by the end of the year and 500,000 by the end of the next, all of it tax-free. They had a list of enemies by the middle of their first month together. That happens when you arrest people and sneak them across borders to The Hague. As their profits and their profile grew, the partners created a false front. Honestly, they needed two, one to hide their profits and another to hide from their families. A Cyprus-based firm handled the legal and insurance paperwork for maritime salvage operations. Cypriot banking is Byzantine enough that the new company would never have to show clients or a profit. The money that poured in was expertly cloaked. For the world at large, Fierro and Finnegan used their contacts to create false identifications for themselves as independent researchers for some far-flung subsidiary agency of the European Union. Finnegan hired a burnout bureaucrat from Manchester who'd retired to the Cypriot city of Gazimaousa, and he churned out one or two breathtakingly dull reports under their names per year. Should anyone look, and nobody had, a paper trail of pristine dullness lay scattered about them like hedge trimmings. They also signed a non-aggression pact with the Central Intelligence Service of the Cyprus Police. In one of their very first cases, they had stumbled upon a con man who'd stolen nearly €500,000 from the police retirement fund. The partners got the money and returned it, no questions asked, no finder fee expected. And Inspector Rafael Triadis, Nicosia Division, it called upon them shortly thereafter to figure out what their game was. Put simply, they were going after criminals, but without the traditional protection of being in law enforcement or connected to any government. They needed a safe haven, in return for which they would offer their services to Inspector Triadis on occasion. Triadis had served as a soldier in Sarajevo during the years-long siege in the 1990s. He held a fierce loathing for war criminals. They reached an agreement, and Triadis had even thrown in an introduction to his cousin, who owned an empty office over a Turkish restaurant in Kyrenia. Now all that was needed was a name for the company. One night, over way too much vodka, they came upon St. Nicholas Salvage and Wrecking. The origin of the name was the partner's secret. Chapter 2. Bruges, Belgium. The club wasn't easy to find. It featured no signage out front. It was up a narrow flight of stairs, tucked above the office of a legal advocate, and nobody would think to enter through the door unless they were seeking an attorney, not a drink. The Illuminati of Belgium's International Diplomatic Corps had used the place for years as a clandestine spot for those times when one wanted complete anonymity. Many affairs of state, and affairs of the heart, began in this nameless place. Catalan Fierro Dahar looked the part. Michael Finnegan didn't. She wore a slim black suit with stilettos. He wore blue chinos and a blue, unstructured jacket, and thought the blues matched. He was the only one who thought so. They walked up the narrow steps, Fierro in the lead, toward the hush of the bar and away from the murmur of the street. She looked back over her shoulder, shaking laser-straight hair out of her eyes. "We need to see about getting you a suit," Finnegan said. "This is a suit." She blinked at him and smiled. Thomas Shannon Grayson waited for them at the bar. English, matchstick lean, aristocratic and charming, he knew the waitstaff by name, knew what football clubs they fancied, although he didn't visit the nameless club but a few times per year. He turned as the duo entered, beaming at them. He presented a champagne cocktail and a tall crystal flute to Fierro. Bubbles glistened from the top. "The champagne is from a vineyard outside of Troyes," he said, his voice pure Eton. "The brandy is a little Armagnac, or Dage, that I've grown fond of. The bitters I discovered in a deplorable cathouse in Trinidad." Fierro took the glass. He handed Finnegan a larger glass. "Pabst. Sweet." Shan, as he was known to friends, led the way deeper into the gloom of the distinguished club, to an ox-blood-red wooden booth with heavy, drawn curtains of green baize. They sidled in, Shan on one side, the partners on the other. The Englishman already had a whiskey and soda waiting. He favored them with his satyr's grin, lifted his glass an inch. "To St. Nicholas, Salvage and Wrecking." They sipped.
"Been meaning to ask you for ages. Where did you come up with that name for your company?" he asked, turning to Fierro.
"Michael is Irish Catholic, but you're Muslim, so I assume it has nothing to do with Kris Kringle."
"My mother's Muslim," she corrected.
"What can we do for you?"
By you, she meant Madame Hélène Bethencourt of Switzerland, the ranking judge of the International Criminal Court. Their company, St. Nicholas Salvage and Wrecking, had now done work for Judge Bethencourt on five other occasions, but they never met with her. Nor would her name come up in this day's conversation. Although the company was well paid for its work, no agency on earth would ever be able to link the money back to the venerable judge. Bounty hunting, by and large, is both illegal and vulgar. Hence Thomas Shannon Grayson, in his bespoke suits and besotted by his own self-image, was the perfect go-between. The Englishman turned his gaze on the American. Finnegan looked as disheveled as usual, with his mop of wavy black hair and a half-day's growth of beard. Michael Finnegan was one of those men who develop a 5 o'clock shadow at 10 in the morning.
"It is good to see you, Michael. How have you been?"
"Drunk. You?"
"Sometimes. Not as often as you'd think."
Fierro had never been good at small talk. She asked again,
"What's this about?"
Shan reached down onto the bench beside his coat and produced an iPad, with a flash drive sticking out of the side like an arrowhead. He swiped it open and turned it to face the partners.
"There's this fellow lives in Serbia.
Lazar Alexich. He's an extremely bad person, and our mutual friend would like very much to see him appear before the International Court. Fierro studied the image. He was a youth, mid-twenties, blonde and handsome. Shan reached over and used a fingertip to bring up more images. The blonde kid skiing, the blonde kid at a bar with a looker in a strapless gown, the blonde kid amid the crowd at a bullfight, smoking a cigarette and laughing hysterically. She looked up at Shan.
Why?
Which part?
Why arrest this man and why us? Start with the first part.
He's pimping underage refugees to pedophiles throughout Europe, Fierro said simply.
Ah.
If I'm right, this tumor of a human is running girls and boys throughout half of the Eurozone. Dozens, maybe scores of kids. Syrians, Afghans, Egyptians. Anyone fleeing to Europe for a new life. And our young master Alexich is on absolutely nobody's radar. Not the local police, not Interpol, nobody.
Vittingen reached over and made the images disappear. He expected a PDF and found it, a file on Lazar Alexich. He started scanning the details.
Fierro said,
That explains why him. Now why us?
Three reasons, the Englishman said. The first is this. As our Michael is about to tell you, we have a great deal of smoke, but no fire. We need an independent agency that will link Lazar Alexich to his victims. Second, he never leaves Belgrade, Serbia, where I assure you he is surrounded by an army of underlings with firearms. He's also bought protection from the Serbian police.
Finnegan was scanning the PDF on the tablet computer. He drained his beer.
This all you've got?
Unfortunately, yes.
Fierro leaned in toward the American and placed an arm on his shoulder, resting her chin on the back of her hand. She peered at the screen as Finnegan scrolled through the document. Shan Grayson waited, watching. They were an unusual pair, he thought. Lovers? One suspected so at first. But they acted more like siblings, or at least very good friends. Shan fancied himself an avid reader of others' body language, and he had trouble figuring out what the principal owners of St. Nicholas Salvage and Wrecking were to each other.
Finnegan said, Guy's mobbed up in Belgrade?
He is indeed.
Fierro brushed long hair away from her face.
You said there was a third reason why the judge... Sorry, why you wanted to hire us.
Shan finished his drink and checked his watch.
There is. Come. I'd like to show you something.
Four blocks away, an association of international attorneys was just finishing the dinner portion of their annual conference. Shan Grayson led the way into the auditorium, handed several folded bills to a waiter, and took the partners to the back of the room, where the coat rack stood sentinel. The speaker for the evening was the director of the Levant Crisis Group at the United Nations High Commission for Refugees. The director had a patrician's frame, an actor's profile, and a resonant baritone. He was a man born to make speeches. He had silver hair and a conservative suit, and a sky-blue enamel lapel pin shaped like a dove in flight. Almost 160 guests of the International Conference on International Law had attended the dinner to hear his keynote address. The attendees sat around white cloth tables and ate prime rib. There were no vacant seats. Liveried waitstaff provided wine and coffee as the guest of honor took the podium without the aid of notes and spoke for 45 minutes straight. Finnegan, Fierro, and Shan Grayson stood in the back and, the way the lights hit the stage, it was unlikely the speaker could spot them. Attorneys at the rearmost tables could see them. Several kept turning to eye the tall, dark woman in the slim suit and stiletto heels. Fierro didn't appear to notice. Finnegan did and smiled. The UN official spoke with passion about the tsunami of immigrants pouring into Europe from Syria, Afghanistan, Sudan, South Sudan, Iraq, Libya, and Egypt. He spoke about the Christian mission of Europeans to help the downtrodden, but also about the enormous burden this had placed on the economy of each member nation. He set the historic landscape, comparing this to the great forced immigrations of World War I and II. He talked with granular detail about the Schengen Agreement, which allowed for free and unfettered border crossings for both people and freight between European nations. He praised the history and ethos of Islam,
but warned of the dark stain of Islamist forces. He was an electrifying speaker, even in English, which wasn't his native tongue. When he wrapped it up, the room rose as one in a spontaneous burst of applause. Photojournalists bathed the lectern in strobes. The speaker moved to the head table and kissed a plump little woman in a cashmere sweater and pearls. She beamed benevolently at him, clearly the doting wife. As the applause continued, Fierro leaned toward the Englishman. "We know where the UN stands on the refugee crisis. What's this got to do with your Serbian bastard?" Finnegan leaned in. "Also, you said there were three reasons you wanted us involved." Shan said, "Right you are. My enfant terrible is Lazar Alexic, and our fine speaker for the day, the director of the Levant Crisis Group at the United Nations High Commission for Refugees, is Milos Alexic, Lazar's loving dad." He pointed toward the wife at the head table. "Maria Alexic, Lazar's mum." Finnegan scratched his stubbly cheek. "Holy shit," Shan said. "Indeed." A waiter walked by with a tray of champagne flutes held shoulder high. Fierro snagged one en passant and drained it in a go. "We're in." Chapter 3. London, England. Rare was the Friday night that didn't find Jane Hurry and Lanny Connors meeting for drinks at Callahan's in Bayswater. The pub was a favorite of young journalists and journalism students, providing cheap beer, half-decent wine, and a relatively good chance of not getting groped at the bar. Jane and Lanny seldom missed a weekend together of Chardonnay and moping. Both had been out of school for 2 years. Both were underemployed. Jane working for peanuts at three news websites, Lanny waiting tables and writing for free on entertainment sites for the exposure. They'd known all the way through school that things would be tough once they got out, but the actual reality of it hit them like a lorry. Which was why Jane's wicked grin caught her best mate by surprise that Friday. "Good Lord," Lanny set down the drinks and huddled in for a good chat. "You've met someone." "Have I?" "I have hell," Jane laughed. Like a lot of second-generation Syrians, she dressed in typical London fashion. Tonight it was jeans, a sweater, and suede boots. Her grandmother might not have approved, but nobody Jane's age wore anything resembling traditional Arabic clothing. At least not in her circles. She was young, only 22. But thanks to a round face and petite build, she was constantly mistaken for a teenager. It was a source of great humor, and possibly a bit of resentment, from the taller and curvier Lanny, whose ancestors had sacked the Scottish coast in longboats. "I'm not seeing anyone," Jane said. "I've got the most brilliant idea ever about my career." Lanny rolled her eyes. "I'd like a brilliant idea about my career. Remind me again, what's my career?" Jane reached over and squeezed her hand. "You're going to be writing for the London Times before you're 30 and running it by 40. Fact." "Not at the pace I'm..." Jane held up a hand and said, "Fact. It's science and you can't argue science. Reporter by 30. Managing editor by 40. Shut up and drink." Lanny did as she was told. Her best friend had more faith in her trajectory than Lanny did herself, which was why she hadn't revealed to Jane the brochures that she'd been gathering for doctoral programs in English literature. If she were going to be a poor, underemployed Londoner, she might as well be Dr. Poor Underemployed Londoner. "So, what's your daft plan?" Lanny asked. Jane unfolded a page from The Guardian. The newsprint was folded precisely, which was Jane's way with everything. It showed a map of the Middle East and Southern Europe, with the Mediterranean as a big blue blob on the left. "Hundreds of thousands of refugees are making the trip, by foot, from Syria to Turkey to Europe. Hundreds of thousands." "I know," she said, shaking her head. "Breaks your heart." "I don't want to break hearts. I want to break stories. Lanny, I'm going." Lanny sipped her white wine. "Where?" "Syria." Lanny then promptly spat white wine across the Guardian. "You're not. That's rubbish. There's no tourism in Syria these days. Nobody's going there but the Red Cross and soldiers." "And journalists." "No," Lanny said adamantly. "Reporters aren't. Do you not know how many journalists have died in the last couple of years in Syria? Gobs." She said gobs as if it were a finite and measurable number, divisible by itself and one. "My uncle lives in Hama,"
He's an editor. I've already written to him, told him my plan. Which is what?
Lanny's voice ratcheted up in disbelief. This didn't seem like Jane's usual but brief foray into a new career opportunity, but instead something she'd thought out.
I'm flying to Beirut. One of his photographers is meeting me there and driving me across the border. I want to focus on refugees. I'll join one of the routes moving north. I plan to interview children, just children.
You're not, Lanny protested.
Love, that's bonkers. You'll be at risk.
Jane shrugged. She reached over to her tote, which shared the third chair with Lanny's leg, and produced an airplane boarding ticket. Lanny shrieked, and suddenly all eyes in the pub were on her.
Shh, God, everyone's looking.
Jane, she replied in a muted tone.
This is barking mad. You can't, it's dangerous. Less so since ISIS or Daesh or whatever was kicked out, she said. Only Damascus and the cities around it are still at war. The rest is just, well, refugees.
But,
and I'm in good shape. I've hiked through Ireland and Wales, Jane said. I've run half marathons. I'm in great shape, and I look like this.
She pointed with both index fingers at her youthful round face. So kids always open up to me.
You don't speak Arabic.
Hello, Houri. I speak Arabic with a Syrian accent. Look. She produced her driver's license. Lanny peered at it. It wasn't made out to Jane Houri. It was made out to Janan Houri.
That's my real name. Nobody calls me that, but it's my name.
Lanny realized the tears were forming in her blue eyes.
Is this for real, then? You're doing this?
Janan Houri of London grinned at her best mate, cupped both of Lanny's hands in her own.
I am. I really am.
Chapter 4 Kyrenia. St. Nicholas Salvage and Wrecking owned a seaplane, currently revving up in the waters of Amsterdam. Finnegan decided he'd rendezvous there with Lachlan Sumner, their pilot, and bring it down to their headquarters in Cyprus. Sumner, a rangy New Zealander, had flown for oil companies, putting down planes everywhere from Alaska to Qatar. There was pretty much no place he couldn't fly to. Fierro hopped a flight to Berlin to see an old friend from her intelligence service days. The Articles of Incorporation for St. Nicholas Salvage and Wrecking were a bit arcane and not easy to track down. The company was headquartered in Kyrenia, Cyprus, which meant, technically, that it was a Cypriot company. But since 1974, the island had been split lengthwise, two-thirds Greek and one-third Turkish. To the government of Cyprus, and to all but one of the 193 members of the United Nations, the island had one government and a Turkish occupying force. To the Turks, the island featured two independent nations, much like Haiti and the Dominican Republic. Kyrenia is on the north, on the Turkish side, and from its shore one can see Turkey on a clear day. It's a small provincial tourist town with a lovely old marina that houses a few dozen luxury sailboats, a semicircle of restaurants, hotels, and Russian casinos, plus a small commercial core, all hemmed in by the Mediterranean to the north and the craggy pentadactyl mountain range to the south. A mammoth fortress overlooks the commercial bay and an identical, mostly unused bay to the east of the town. From the air, the two bays and the fortress look like a capital W, with a looming stone fort between the inlets. The bay to the west has a functioning seawall to protect the sailboats. The bay to the east does not, and is used mainly by local companies. Companies such as St. Nicholas Salvage and Wrecking, which had purchased the rights to tie down a de Havilland DHC-6300 Twin Otter seaplane in the lesser-used bay. Thanks to the bifurcated nature of life on Cyprus since the 1974 Civil War, tracking down information on a company based out of Kyrenia is difficult at best. Plus, the island is known for its obtuse and opaque banking regulations. It had become a favorite haven for Russian mobsters hoping to hide money from their country's crooked government. Sauce for the goose. The murkiness of the Cypriot banking and business world worked just as well for Michael Finnegan and Catalin Fierro Dahar. After visiting her friend in Berlin, Fierro flew commercial to Larnaca, Cyprus, the country's only large commercial airport. Cyprus is a small country. The best method of getting from one city to the next is taxi, and the price rarely rises above €30. St. Nicholas Salvage and Wrecking kept a Land Rover in a garage close to Larnaca, just past the salt marsh lakes with their massive flocks of flamingos. Fierro threw her overnight bag in the back and checked the lockbox to make sure she had euros for the Greek side of the island and Turkish lira for the north. She drove straight through, circling the capital of Nicosia, crossing at the UN checkpoint, and got to Kyrenia inside of 2 hours. Bridget Sumner, wife of their pilot, Lachlan Sumner, ran the shop when the principals were away. Fierro got back to find everything tidy and a note from Bridget informing them that she was at home but could run back if needed. St. Nicholas Salvage and Wrecking kept a suite of offices on 3 levels, perched precariously above a restaurant that overlooked the commercial marina. A flood of tourists, mostly Turkish and British, strolled the promenade below the oatmeal-colored abode. The office was set back enough to provide privacy from the people below. Fierro showered and changed into raggedy cut-off jeans and a vintage Ramones t-shirt. She poured herself a vodka and sat out on their tight little balcony. She'd rescued 2 floatable cushions from a friend's boat and used them as a seat on the balcony and a support behind her back. The Turkish restaurant below did the most amazing seafood, and the aromas of saffron and ginger floating up to their loft never ceased to amaze. The town gleamed, especially at night, with its combination of late 19th century and pre-war romanticism. The great rocky fortress loomed to the east, reminding the town of its Venetian and Ottoman history. The French House of Lusignan had ruled its slice of the Mediterranean from this island, back when its kingdom included Jerusalem and Armenia. Aphrodite had come from this oblong rock in the sea, if one believed that sort of thing. Fierro sometimes did. Pygmalion's statue had come to life on this island. Othello had served here before his encounter with Iago. Or so the story goes. Fierro studied the files on the encrypted flash drive that Shan Grayson had given them. She sipped her vodka until the sun set, then went inside to pull on a ratty, stretched-out sweater, grabbed another bottle of vodka from the icebox in the staff kitchen, and padded back out to the balcony to sit on her cushions, reading now beneath the light pouring out the office window. She and Finnegan kept living quarters on the top level of the 3-floor suite. Her mother texted her from Madrid. Khadija Dahar's birthday was coming up. There would be no good way to avoid seeing the family, no matter how much she tried. She called it a night around 1. She awoke at 10, threw on gym shorts and a jog top and shoes, and ran 8 miles east toward the town of Bellepais, doing the hill work that she preferred 3 days per week. Thanks to the elevation gain, her long, deeply tanned body was sheathed in sweat by the time she returned downtown. The village was coming alive, the air smelling of fresh shellfish and ground coffee. The midday Muslim call to prayer, the Zuhr, reverberated from minarets up and down the valley. The sound always reminded her of her mother and of growing up in the Muslim quarter of Cadiz. She showered and got a plate of olives, feta, and fresh bread from the restaurant downstairs, along with a beaten copper plate with a cup of good Turkish coffee and a sealed plastic container of water, the way it's always served on Cyprus. She recognized a happy sound and stepped out on the balcony to watch as the company's de Havilland Otter descended from the skies, its twin Pratt & Whitney's purring. The Otter was outfitted with pontoons that summer, although she often was rigged in stall. Short takeoff and landing, formation with a fixed tricycle gear. Fierro watched as the Kiwi, Lachlan Sumner, brought the plane in as light as a love song. Fierro retrieved her mobile phone from the desk in her suite and hit the number 1 speed dial. Finnegan spoke up over the roar of the twin engines. She could tell by the audio quality that he'd taken the call over the Otter's headsets. "Yo!" She shielded her eyes and watched as their plane cruised beyond the great Venetian fortress toward the lesser bay and out of sight. "Smoke," she said, watching. "Little fire. We need to get started on this." Finnegan said, "Agreed." "Hey, it's your mom's birthday on Thursday." Fierro said, "Shut up," and disconnected. Chapter 5. Beirut, Lebanon. It worked like a charm. Jane Houri, Jinan, she reminded herself, flew from Gatwick to Ankara, then took a smaller plane to Beirut. Tamer Awad, a 30-year-old photojournalist from the newspaper in Hama, met her at the airport. She'd purchased a hijab from a shop near Gatwick and had gone to YouTube to remind herself how to drape it around her head and shoulders. She hadn't worn one in ages.
"You look fine," Tamer said. "How's your Arabic?"
Jane laughed.
"I'm Syrian, Tamer. I speak fluent Arabic."
The journalist's smile faltered.
"What's that accent?"
Jane blushed.
"It's Syrian."
The guy laughed. He pointed to his Nissan Sentra, parked just outside the airport gates.
"If you say so."
Chapter 6 Kyrenia. Over a lunch of grilled lamb and salads with Turkish olive oil and lemon, the partners shared what they'd learned about Lazar Aleksic.
"What is this kid, 19? He asked.
"He's 25.
Finnegan just shook his head. "They get younger every year."
"It's not his youth that bothers me. His victims are underage. According to Shan, maybe as young as 12 or 13.
Finnegan looked momentarily ill. "Selling them to pimps and whorehouses, but also private buyers. That's just..." He rubbed his eyes with the heels of his hands.
"Evil, I know."
They ordered white wine. Fierro nibbled on her lamb. She wore black, as always, a simple tank and matchstick jeans with suede ankle boots. She pulled her hair back in the Spanish style, parted in the middle, and in a low chignon at the base of her neck. Finnegan also wore a standard outfit, 501s and a button-down shirt untucked. His tousled haircut was a few weeks past its sell-by date. He hadn't shaved since Bruges, but it all looked good on him. Fierro pointed toward the laptop between them.
"Aleksic grew up very rich. There are stories of his getting into trouble with the law in Serbia, in France, in Belgium, and his father bailing him out."
"His father, who was director of a UN Middle Eastern refugee program."
"Which means serious clout," she added.
"What's Junior been doing since he came of age?"
"According to Shan, he's connected with Serbian mobsters, whether Milos Aleksic knows or not."
She gave a very Iberian shrug, conveying tons.
"Mobsters?"
"Formerly Serbian military. The name military that committed atrocities in the 1990s during the Yugoslavian Civil War. When the war ended, they turned to organized crime."
The owner of the restaurant swung by the table with their wine. He didn't mind Fierro Dahar, a half-Muslim woman, sharing liquor with Finnegan. Cyprus is a most secular country, even by Turkish standards.
"Who are the victims?"
She took a moment to bring up a map of Europe and the Mediterranean.
"Since the wars in Syria and Afghanistan, the refugee trail into Europe has looked like this."
She pointed to the screen.
"From the Middle East, north into Turkey. From there, refugees take three routes. The middle route is Turkey to Greece, Greece to Macedonia and Kosovo, then on to Serbia and parts farther north, such as Hungary. Or they head from Macedonia through Bosnia and Croatia and on to Austria."
Finnegan nodded.
"The northern route goes Turkey to Bulgaria, to Romania, to Hungary. The western route goes Turkey by boat from the southern coast to Greece, then across the Adriatic by boat to Italy."
"So the middle route..." He licked lemon juice off his fingers. "You need someone in Serbia to exploit the refugees."
"Serbia or Kosovo, yes. Closer to Greece and you find too many observers. From the UN, from the media, from the Red Cross and Red Crescent."
Finnegan thought about it a while.
"In the Marshall Service, we like to keep our eyes on the borders. Borders create bottlenecks. That's where coyotes exploit victims."
"Coyotes?"
"Colloquialism. Traffickers."
"Ah. Anyway, I see your point. Does Aleksic make contact with his victims in Belgrade? Or will they come across the border in Kosovo?"
"We need to connect Aleksic to his victims. We need to know where he gathers them."
He leaned back, sipped his wine, mulled over the problem.
"Jeez, I'd love to put this Vance in prison."
"Is Vance like coyote?"
"No, it means bedbug. But in this case, yeah."
"To prey on little children and on refugees."
Fierro's eyes had taken on a stormy, slate-gray sheen. Her partner knew the warning signs when he saw them.
"We don't get paid if Aleksic is dead."
She leveled that gray gaze on him for a while, and Finnegan held it, return serve. She finally gave him a warning smile.
"I don't kill everyone I meet."
Finnegan signaled for the check. "Not for lack of trying." After lunch, he returned to their office over the town of Kyrenia, checked his watch, and did his calculations for the time back in the States. He called a few friends from the Marshals Service, from the DEA and the FBI. He thought about it a while, then looked up a number for a guy who worked for the New York State Police and who'd worked a number of cases involving the Little Odessa gangs in the U.S. from the post-Soviet era. They hadn't spoken in a while. The state cop called him back inside of 5 minutes.
Finnegan himself calls me. I think wonders just ceased.
Finnegan threw open the double doors to the narrow balcony overlooking the sailboats of the Kyrenian Marina. The sky was crystalline, and Turkey shimmered near the horizon.
How's it going? How's Caroline?
She's good. You still bumming around Europe, writing love ballads and reading Yeats?
It's Keats this year, you soulless bastard. Hey, you know anyone knows anyone connected to the scene in Belgrade, Serbia?
The statey laughed.
You consulting on this thing, Mickey?
I'm asking. He didn't elaborate.
The guy said, this a St. Nicholas thing? I'm not as stupid as I look.
Don't see how you could be.
Finnegan hadn't realized that his old friends knew he was bounty hunting. But then again, this particular state cop collected knowledge the way some people collect stamps. There didn't seem much point in denying it.
Yeah, it's that. My partner and me are looking at a guy runs underage vics for whorehouses and private collectors. Guy targets Middle Eastern refugees.
Ah, jeez. Yeah.
Finnegan listened to the pause over the phone. Below their office, British expats laughed and strolled the curved boardwalk on their way to one of the many casinos in town.
You know who would know for sure, right?
Finnegan said. Let's not get into that, okay?
How's Patty doing?
Don't know. Guy we're looking into, he may be using ex-Serb military. Death squad guys from the Civil War in the 90s. What I need is someone elsewhere in Europe who can point me to the receiving side of the network. I want to work it from that end, heading toward Belgrade.
Makes sense. Not a lot of Micks badging their way around Belgrade, I figure.
Okay, I'll ask around.
Thanks. This is a bad guy, buys and sells children, breaks up refugee families. We'd really like to put him away.
You maybe don't know this, buddy, but St. Nicholas is gaining a reputation. A good one. I'll ask around.
Thanks, man.
He was about to hang up as his friend cut back in.
No problem.
But call your old man, okay? Finnegan got some laundry going and changed the sheets on both beds. Fierro treasured her privacy, but having a partner who did laundry, for that she was willing to cut him some slack. He took a look at whatever important papers Bridget Sumner had put on his desk. They involved Cypriot banking, and he understood absolutely nothing about them. Bridget left a post-it telling him to sign them, so he did. He checked his watch and realized he could get to the capital, Nicosia, for the 10:30 English Mass at Holy Cross Church. The drive itself took less than a half hour on the small island. Finnegan liked to tell his friends and co-workers that he went to Mass so he wouldn't have to lie to his mom about it later. But really, he went because it was a lifetime's habit, and he enjoyed it. He slept fitfully that night. The next morning, he again hustled around, cleaned his suite of rooms. He took out the trash. He scanned Facebook and Twitter. He contemplated cleaning out the fridge. He stared into it for a while and threw away some cheese. He said, "Oh, for God's sake," and broke down and called his dad. It was a Saturday, and his father would be camped out in his lounger, beer at hand, watching college sports. Always college sports, regardless of the season. Captain Patrick Finnegan, Patty to his old friends, couldn't abide pro ball.
"Mickey, how the hell are you?"
Finnegan went to stand before the balcony again. A classic wood-sided 30-footer was making a spinnaker run toward the breakwater, the sun glistening off its deck, a long-legged girl in a huge floppy hat lying on a beach towel.
"I'm doing good, Dad. What's on the tube?"
"Baseball, Arizona, UC San Diego. Where are you?"
"Cyprus, Dad."
"Sand, sun, and babes."
Patrick Finnegan assumed that Cyprus, Coney Island, and Miami were interchangeable. Not that he could visit any of them, not with the electronic tether in his ankle bracelet. They talked about family. They talked about baseball and about politics. Patrick Finnegan couldn't believe how much the politicians were screwing the country, screwing the working man. As always. Michael didn't think his old man had ever voted, but he'd served enough corrupt politicians over the years that he had a right to an opinion.
"Hey, Nicole is up for a promotion. How's Sergeant Nicole Finnegan sound?"
His old man sounded so full of pride.
His only daughter, wearing the blue. Finnegan said, well, she's the smartest member of the family, so... And left it at that. When he'd left the NYPD, his 2 years younger sister had been just about to finish at the academy. Another Finnegan walking in Patty's footprints. The day he handed in his badge, Michael had warned his sister about what she was getting into. It was the last time they'd spoken seriously.
How about you? Patrick said. You think much about getting a real job?
This job's pretty real, Dad.
The former captain laughed. Jesus, you work in a goddamn cubicle, Mickey. Guys are out doing shit and you're writing reports.
Finnegan stared at the Eastern Med. Something like that. It's a job. He'd never had any intention of saying to his father, I'm a bounty hunter. Bounty hunting is illegal. And back in the States, as a New York cop and later as a deputy U.S. Marshal, Michael Finnegan had had zero tolerance for the illegal activities that got his father booted off the force, that got him 18 months at a federal lockup. Patrick Finnegan's criminal nature is what drove Michael to leave NYPD in the first place, and he hadn't been shy letting his old man know that. Michael had been angry and unforgiving. How then now to say his own path wasn't exactly on the up and up?
No, look, I'm sorry, kiddo. A job's a job. A lot of guys are on the dole, you know. Being a bean counter in a cube ain't the same as taking welfare. Hey, how's you and Kathy?
Catalan.
You an item, you two?
We work in the same office. You doing okay, staying out of trouble? He heard the subtle change of tone in his dad's voice. Heard him glug from the beer can.
Just watching some ball, kiddo. Just watching some ball.
Sure, Michael said. You're as clean as Mom's floor. He listened to nothing. The 30-footer came around, aligned for the entry to the marina.
Your mother's floor wasn't all that clean.
Michael blushed. Sorry he'd pushed that particular button. He knew that his old man had had great contacts in New York's immigrant crime communities, including the Slavs. In his day, Patrick Finnegan had known a little something about everything. He thought about bringing up Belgrade.
Patrick said, "You talked to your mother lately?"
"Last week."
"She sounds good."
Patrick said, "Good, good." The silence reigned. In the background, the crack of an aluminum bat, the soft susurrus of a happy crowd. Somewhere in Arizona or California, people were buying dogs with spicy mustard, watching hyper-athletic cheerleaders, and second-guessing managers. Somewhere, it was America. Somewhere. Just not in Cyprus.
Hey, Dad, I gotta go.
You bet, Patrick Finnegan said.
Oh, hey, you remember a jack-off named Berkovsky at the DA's office?
Finnegan squeezed his eyes shut and rubbed the lids with the pads of his finger and thumb.
Berkowski.
Fucking guy, Patrick Finnegan said, and then nothing.
What's going on, Dad?
Hmm?
Nothing. Berkowski, the guy's a dickless twerp with nothing better to do.
Nothing better than what? You into something, Dad?
I'm into a fucking baseball game on TV, Mickey. I'm about halfway into a can of Coors. What do you think? I got this bracelet on my ankle. You think maybe I'm taking belly dancing lessons at the junior college?
Berkowski, with the New York District Attorney's Office, specialized in high-profile corruption cases. Current cases, not old cases.
What's he want with you?
Ah, who knows with these Jews? Finnegan and Berkowski had gone to the same high school. The Berkowskis were Polish Catholic.
What'd you do?
Patrick said, I didn't do anything, Mickey, okay? Guy's got a hard-on for me, understand? Finnegan rested his forehead against the sill, the breeze of the Mediterranean blowing his hair. He closed his eyes.
Mickey?
Yeah?
Hey, I gotta go, long distance.
Sure, not made of money.
Okay, he said. I'll call next week.
Love you, bye. It had been a hell of a childhood. Patty Finnegan taught his son to be a tough little bastard. He paid for boxing lessons. He also taught him all the things the other kids could only dream of. How to throw a punch, how to pick a lock, how to count cards. Patty taught his daughter Nicole much of the same stuff. Partly because she wanted to be a cop like her dad, partly so she could take care of herself around boys.
The Finnegans are cops because the world needs rules, and we need someone to make sure everybody plays by the rules, his old man had told both kids, sitting on a stoop and watching the sunset.
Mickey was 14, Nicole was 12.
But that don't mean we have to follow all of those rules.
Nicole said. How come?
You ever watch basketball?
All the time, Mickey said. Ever see anyone call a foul on the ref? Both kids laughed. But in truth, they'd never thought about it before.
No.
Of course not. The refs keep the peace. But the refs don't have to follow the same rules. They can't. That's not how the world works.
Patty had handed over the bag and bottle. You remember that?
A decade later, Michael Patrick Finnegan turned out to be an exemplary cadet at the same police academy that had accepted his grandfather and his uncles and his dad. New York's finest had known two generations of Finnegan boys and was happy to accept the third. Michael had partnered well as a rookie, got placed in a major crimes unit that most cops would have given their eye teeth for. For the first year, a voice in the back of his head warned him that something was wrong. It wasn't just that his old man was popular. It wasn't just that his family had a legacy of law enforcement. No, there was something else. By the second year, he understood. The Finnegan boys were connected, majorly connected. And Michael would be, too, once he'd earned his bones. Young Officer Finnegan finally got drunk enough to ask Captain Patrick Finnegan about it, one night in an Irish bar in the Lower East Side.
"This is the way the world works, kiddo," his father had said. "You can be inside or you can be outside. And Mickey, inside's a shitload better, in all ways."
Michael Patrick Finnegan resigned from the NYPD a week and a half later, and Nicole Finnegan's admission to the police academy was accepted the following day. Michael had been with the U.S. Marshal's office for a full 2 years before the district attorney brought charges of corruption against Captain Patrick Finnegan. The case took 15 months to work its way to a guilty verdict. Deputy U.S. Marshal Michael Patrick Finnegan never returned to New York during that time. He accepted calls from his father and from his mother, but he knew that the lines were tapped. He begged off from conversation within a minute or two every time. He and Nicole stopped talking. He read about his dad's conviction in USA Today while sitting outside a tavern in Laredo, watching a Texas Ranger sell 10-gauge Benellis out of the back of his pickup to 15-year-old Ciudad warlords. A year later, he'd been assigned to a task force in Crimea, charged with bringing home a Ukrainian drug lord codenamed Pantomime. The Spanish CNI served as a partner agency in the task force, along with their Oscura Sicaria, Catalin Fierro Dahar. With Shan Grayson's flash drive as a starting point, the partners spent the next 2 days in Kyrenia doing online research, reaching out to sources, and learning what they could without straying too close to the target. Bridget Sumner brought up articles of incorporation for Lazar Alexic's company, Ragusa Logistics. Fierro explained that, in European parlance, logistics meant trucking. She asked about Patrick over kebabs and ouzo.
"Did you ask your father about Serbian organized crime?"
Finnegan nodded and hummed and focused on his food. The next day, the investigator from the New York State Police called and said he'd heard of a guy in Italy who maybe could help.
"Guy's a walking shit show, Mickey, so no need to play nice."
"Thanks, man. Where can we find this guy?"
"Milan? And Finnegan?"
"Yeah."
"He's child trafficker's brother," the investigator said. "Go get him."
Chapter 7. Hama, Syria. Jane Houri underwent 2 days of orientation alongside the photojournalist she'd met in Damascus, Tamer Awad. Tamer, she discovered, had won awards, first for his work in Egypt, then during the Syrian civil war. He would be making the trip too, with the understanding that Jane and Tamer were working first for her uncle's newspaper and then for whichever European newspaper they could freelance their work out to. Jane and Tamer went hiking around the city both nights, along both banks of the Orontes River, and it soon became clear that the Londoner, at 5'2", could outmarch the tall, lanky photographer. Jane got to see the famous norias, or water wheels of Hama. She began writing stories both in Arabic for her uncle and in English for Lanny Connors, who was both her best mate and a wicked good copy editor. On a Wednesday, Jane and Tamer took off to meet a caravan of cars driving north with refugees, fleeing homes in the south. It was like some sort of surreal street rally, 1,000 older model cars all facing north, all filled with children and grandparents, furniture and luggage, dogs and even goats. The caravan stopped for dinner near the ancient city of Ebla.
Jane walked around the campground with Tamer in tow. He left his cameras in the Nissan. She peeled away from him from time to time to find youths to interview. She looked like a teenager, and Tamer, 30, well, he looked like a guy in his 30s. It quickly became obvious that she had better results approaching kids by herself than in tandem. The stories were so similar and so depressing. Jane used the journalist's trick of distancing herself, observing the story from afar to keep from tearing up. She spoke to the Bakur family of four, huddled around a campfire and sharing lentil soup. The mother and father immediately wanted to know where she was from. Her accent was fooling no one. They consented to a Western journalist talking to their children, mostly because Jane wore the hijab and looked innocuous enough. Mohammed, 15, and Amira, 13, told her about the bombings in Homs and about losing their house and their school. Mohammed looked like an angry grasshopper, all arms and legs, elbows and knees, and a scowl that could melt tin. Amira showed almost no emotion, a side effect of a childhood lived in a war zone. Jane never touched a notebook for the first hour. During the second, she asked the parents if Tamer could join them. He dropped into the grass and set down his aging canvas camera bag with its well-duct-taped shoulder strap. He cleaned lenses and fiddled with filters, listening to the stories. By the time his shutter flipped for the first time, the kids were completely used to his presence. Jane and Tamer spent the next 2.5 hours getting the stories of Mohammed and Amira and their parents. Jane fought with her internal angels. She was shocked and saddened by the youth's tale, but also profoundly fulfilled. This was journalism. This was important. This was her dream. 2 days later, she got an Instagram that showed Lanny's toothy grin and an email from the Irish Times, which had accepted her first proposed story on the child refugees of Homs. Chapter 8. Milan, Italy. Finnegan and Fierro arranged to meet Brad Mason, former agent of the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, at a seedy bar in an industrial district outside Milan, close to Malpensa Airport. They'd been told that Mason was a tough guy, a ladies' man, and well-bent. He'd come under fire from his old agency for playing both sides against the middle and pocketing the profit. They had left the De Havilland tied up at Santa Margherita di Ligure, on the northern Italian coast, and drove a rental straight north to the rendezvous. Finnegan had cooked up a story about looking for a European source for Mexican cocaine and felt that Mason might just be the guy to help him out, for a price. Rather than go directly to the bar for the meeting, they staked out Mason's place in central Milan first. Bridget Sumner had found the address for them via the magic lantern of her desktop computer back in Kyrenia. They'd hired her for her bookkeeping skills, but she'd proven to be an adept online digger as well. Finnegan had used every source he knew in Italian law enforcement, so they had the guy's background and a surveillance photo of him. 40 minutes before the meeting, they saw him stroll out of his apartment, adjusting his fly, and saunter off toward a splashy Stingray convertible. As soon as he was out of sight, the partners stepped out of their Renault and headed toward his place. Finnegan looked around and said, "Good cop or bad cop?" Fierro used an open palm to swipe her hair away from her face. "I'm not any kind of cop." Brad Mason arrived at the airport bar 10 minutes early and staked out a place where he could watch the door. He had snorted a line in the Ray, cruising out to the meeting, and was feeling good, loose, and ready. Profits definitely could be up this year, no question about it, and any new contact was worth making. Still, he packed the Smith & Wesson because, hell, why not? The potential buyer was late. Mason downed his first beer and was halfway through his second when this leggy, languid vision began walking toward the bar. She had to be 5'10", he guessed, with a mane of black hair hanging to the middle of her back, wearing a badass biker jacket and painted on jeans. Mason hardly noticed the loser with her, some guy for sure, but he was like a planet orbiting too close to the sun. There, but you had to squint to see him. This, Mason thought, should be good. Finnegan and Fierro were late on purpose, letting him stew a bit. They entered and moved to his table, Fierro sitting to his left, Finnegan to his right, pinning him in. Finnegan was on his cell phone saying, "Thanks, Pietro, appreciate it." He hung up and smiled. "Mason, how you doing?" Mason studied Finnegan, noting the couple days' beard growth, a messy mop of wavy hair, and world-weary slouch. He turned to Fiero, who sat with her fists jammed into the side-slit pockets of the biker jacket. She'd worn sunglasses outside and didn't bother taking them off. Mason addressed her. "This is a fine day. A fine day. Buy you a drink?" Finnegan said. "I'm Ken. This is Barbie. Barbie, this is Brad Mason." Fiero said, "Hello, Brad Mason." Mason turned Finnegan. "Something I can help you with, Ken?" "I think maybe, yeah. We're looking into human trafficking, Middle Eastern refugees moving through Serbia." Mason glared at him. He had probably 40 pounds on Finnegan, plus he was armed. "The fuck do I care?" "Word is, you know a lot about moving product on the other side of the Adriatic, the former Yugoslavia. We're told you're the man." "That what you're told?" Rather than wait for a response, he turned back to Fiero, who might have fallen asleep behind the shades. "Ask your boyfriend if he'll go out. Find me a pack of cigarettes, will you? I don't mind talking to you, but..." "Sex workers," Finnegan said. "Underage. Probably Middle Eastern kids on the refugee trail, coming up through Greece. This ringing any bells?" Mason turned back. "No. But if you're looking for an underage boy to play with, I might be able to hook you up. Guy like you, you should do really good in some neighborhoods around here." "Yeah?" Finnegan took no umbrage. "Know anything about organized crime in Serbia?" "Where?" Fiero sighed. A Spanish sigh, like a Spanish shrug, can speak whole paragraphs. She stood, hands still in her pockets, leveraging herself upright by the strength and balance of her long legs. "Do you have any money?" Finnegan. "How much?" "Hang on," she walked to the bar. Watching her walk from behind was one of the finest moments of Mason's year to date. He downed his beer. He said, "Sorry, I can't help you, Ken." "You sure you don't know about Serbian gangs?" "Sorry." Fiero returned, sunglasses hiding her eyes.
300,
Finnegan said. "Really? That seem high to you?" She shrugged. "Okay." He pulled out his wallet, handed her a wad of euros. She walked back to the bartender, handed him the bills. Mason watched her ass. "That is some prime grade A talent there. What are you, her brother, her driver?" "I drive sometimes, yeah." Mason kept his eyes on her as she talked to the bartender. It seemed like a serious discussion. "What the hell is she buying for 300, champagne?" "We live in a service economy, Mason. Not a product economy. She's buying a service. Less and less people are making shit and selling it." Finnegan paused, thinking. "Maybe it's fewer and fewer." Mason said, "It's time for you to fuck off. Know the name Lazar Aleksic?" "Nope." "Anyone in Serbia you can recommend we start with?" "Wish I could help, Ken." Fiero was walking back now, the bartender still watching her, and also watching the two strangers in the booth. Mason said, "I don't know who steered you my way. I don't know anything about anything." She drew her hands out of her side pockets, planted her boots shoulder-width apart, grabbed a handful of Mason's hair at the back of his head, and drove him face-first into the table. Cartilage crackled. The glass of beer went flying. Mason found himself blinded by blood in his eyes and a searing laser of pain that ricocheted through his brain as if the interior of his skull had become a concave disco ball. Finnegan said, "300 for a broken nose?" "His bar, his prices." Fiero yanked Mason's head back, straining his neck. "God, Jesus!" He tried spitting out blood, realizing it was draining from his nose, through his nasal passage into his gullet. "Serbia," she said, her voice revealing no hint of emotion, shades hiding her eyes. "Hoard out refugee children." Mason spat up a bloody gob. "I don't know the fuck you're..." She slammed her left fist into his gut, and when he hunched in, she again drove his face into the table. He felt as much as heard more cracking from his nose. She pulled him back up, and Mason puked down the front of his blood-sodden shirt. "Serbia, hoard out refugee children." Mason drooled blood and beer and breakfast down his front. He gasped for air. "Jesus, you bitch!" He tried to struggle but had no leverage. He pawed for the Smith he kept in a kidney holster. The holster was empty. Finnegan had taken it, set it on the table. Fiero said, "How much do we have left?" "Let's see." Finnegan took Mason's wallet, started rifling through his money. "Mason's got, 1,200 in euros. Figure if a broken nose goes for 3.
Mason raised both hands, palms forward, fingers splayed, and blinked blood out of his eyes.
Okay, all right, all right.
He spat to clear his mouth. The pain was like a drizzle of Tabasco oozing through his skull.
Basha. Drayton Basha. He runs...
Mason spat again.
Runs all the kids coming out of Serbia.
Fierro said. Who is he?
I don't know. I sell to pimps time to time, okay? They say Drayton Basha. I don't ask questions.
He blinked tears out of his eyes. Finnegan thumbed through his wallet and took out his Italian driver's license, pink laminate with patentee di guida and Repubblica Italiana in the upper corners. He said,
Thanks, man. The name Drayton Basha doesn't pan out. We come back. If it does, and we find out you've talked to him or to anyone mobbed up in Syria, then we give him this and tell him we chatted. Yeah?
Fucking, he tried wiping his face, and the searing pain from his nose made him weep. Finnegan reached into his jacket pocket and produced a human figure, 6 inches high, with a base. It was painted lead, a cowboy twirling a lariat over his head. It looked just like the figurine that stood on the table at the entrance to Mason's apartment, where he kept his keys. Finnegan said,
Here's the other news. We stopped at your place before coming here. We found a shitload of coke behind your fridge, dude, like enough to distribute to friends and family. I'll be honest with you, I'm a cop.
Once I saw all that blow, I felt obligated to contact Pietro Calpano at the Carabinieri. He runs the drugs and vice squad in Milan. You know him? Good guy. Terrible tennis player. Pietro appreciated the tip, said they'd hit your apartment about, Finnegan checked his watch.
Mason groaned. You're a son of a...
I was you, I'd lay low for a while. They might have the tags for that kick-ass stingray. I don't know, but I wouldn't bet my freedom on it. I'd get out of Italy fast as I could. You got friends elsewhere? I'd go hang out in elsewhere.
Mason tried to breathe through his mouth.
Fierro reached for Mason's gun and took out the bullets, dumping them in his pocket. He stood and nodded to Fierro.
We good?
Fierro deadpanned him through her shades.
Barbie?
I thought it was funny.
Ken has no genitalia.
They moved toward the door. Finnegan left all of Mason's money in front of the bartender, turned back to his partner.
Was hoping you wouldn't go there.